With the ever more urgent flooding crisis, is there any other option but to seek higher ground? I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
Climate change. Yeah, anybody doubt it's real? March 2024 looks to be the third wettest March in history. I can't believe how much rain we've had, and for so long. Indulge me, my own personal story. A car I absolutely loved last August went through a series of deep puddles, along with lots of other cars. When I got to my house, the dead-end road looked peaceful. It was flat. Well, it was knee-deep in water. Water got into my air filter and killed my beloved car dead. Ugh. As every builder knows, one cannot overestimate the power of water. It goes where it wants to go, and to prevent damage, it can cause a remarkable amount of understanding and engineering has to be built into any project. Probably most often, the water outsmarts the human. There's the old story of King Canute setting his throne by the seashore and commanding the incoming tide to halt and not to wet his feet and robes. And I don't remember long ago what they were selling on TV ads that said, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. Oh, wow, right, that was. Many seashore homeowners have dumped huge amounts of sand in hopes of maintaining their treasured beach, only to have it washed away with remarkable ease by those tides. In recent times, we've seen storm after storm inflict great damage to homes and roadways. And with great regularity, those damaged homes have been rebuilt right where they're often at taxpayer expense. And as the great philosopher Rocky the Squirrel said to Bullwinkle the Moose after he kept trying to pull a rabbit from his hat, that trick never works. Water is real. Water is powerful. Water is alluring. The phrase water view boosts home sale prices substantially. And the power of water offers crucial and timely lessons for humans today. Our guest on today's Keeping Democracy Alive is Tim Palmer, author of a new book on this topic with its ever-increasing significance, the title of which is Seek Higher Ground, the Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. Palmer says trying to out-engineer nature isn't just harmful to our planet, but ultimately futile in trying to stop our losses by flooding. Water is indeed everywhere. And in this age of faster-than-expected global warming and bigger than we've ever seen storms dumping huge amounts of water in inopportune places, Tim Palmer offers in his book a key to living in harmony with rivers and lakes and streams. Tim Palmer is the author of more than 30 books of texts and photographs about the rivers, the environment, and adventure travel. For 50 years, he's been actively involved in flooding and floodplain management issues nationwide as a land use planner, writer, photographer, and river conservation advocate who's won many honors for his work and his books. He lives on the coast of southern Oregon and speaks to academic, professional, conservation, and recreation audiences nationwide. I live on the very short coast of New Hampshire and speak to all who tune in. Tim Palmer, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. Boy, is this timely, but your experience in 1972 put you way ahead of the curve that we find so challenging in the mid-21st century. Please tell us about that and how it affected your job as the county's environmental planner back in 72.
Sure, Bert, I'd love to do that. First, let me say I'm just thrilled to be on your program here and eager to talk with you about this subject that you have introduced so beautifully to us here today. In 1972, I happened to be living at the epicenter of what became the most expensive flood in American history up to that time. Since then, the damage has been eclipsed many times over. But back then, this was the big one. It was called the Hurricane Agnes flood. It reached way into New England. Some of your listeners probably remember this. But at any rate, I lived in a small Appalachian village about 3 hours to the west of New York City in the north central highlands of Pennsylvania, along a tributary to the west branch of the Susquehanna River. Really, all it did was rain for 3 days, but the water came up and up and up, and eventually to the top step of the house where I was living. And fortunately, it stopped there. I did not personally get flooded, but lots of neighbors did, and I ended up helping them shovel out. And as soon as the water began to subside and the roads reopened, they closed for a number of days because of bridges out and landslides and so forth. But as soon as the roads cleared, I went back to my job, which happened to be as environmental planner for Lycoming County, Pennsylvania. And there it was my duty not only to help in the recovery, but also to figure out how we could avoid having this problem again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that led me to look carefully at what had happened way back then. And that was that the dams built with the intention to stop floods had filled and did not stop the floods at all. The levees that were built to keep floods away from our homes and businesses failed. In Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, one levee failure flooded 100,000 people. And ultimately, the relief paid to flood victims was fundamentally ineffective in that it did nothing to help prevent this kind of catastrophe from occurring again. So it became very clear to me that, number one, what we needed to do was, first of all, prevent new development from occurring on floodplains wherever possible. And in fact, 90% of our floodable acreage in America is not heavily developed. If we allowed it to be so, the problem could get 9 times worse than it already is. Mm. So that's number one. Number two is we need to help people move off of floodplains and relocate to safer ground wherever they are willing to go.
Mm.
So those two principles became the foundation for this book that I have written now 50 years later.
Mm. You know, we'd rather just bury our heads in the sand and not look at this. It's so much easier not to look at this. But it's real. It's happening more and more and more often. And we've seen so often after floods, one after the other, 100-year storm after next 100-year storm, after each flood, there are big relief efforts. Talk about the value of these, please.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. The floods are coming more often. You know, what was considered a 100-year storm
right
is happening repeatedly. I mean, a poor place like Ellicott City, Maryland, they had a 500-year storm, in quotes, and a 1,000-year storm 2 years later.
Oh, geez.
And, you know, so something's wrong here, and I go into a lot of detail on many things that are wrong in that picture. But the point is here we have to find a different way. You know, we have to quit investing so much in the futile efforts to control nature and rely more thoroughly on what we can do to affect our own behavior and our own decisions on where we live and where we develop and invest in floodplain property.
Oh, but it's so hard to change behavior. We like what we're doing. We want to keep doing what we're doing. So we keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and more damage is caused. And, you know, we've all heard about climate change for a long time, but, you know, we've not wanted to do anything about changing our behavior. It's just so hard to do, to ask people to change their behavior. Well, what are attempts? Why are attempts to control nature and contain flooding by out-engineering nature perhaps actually harmful to our planet?
Yeah. So, as far as the guiding principle here, let me put it this way:
mm-hmm.
We've regarded the laws of nature as optional when, in fact, they are absolute. And meanwhile, we regard our own habits and customs and laws as immutable, when in fact we can change them whenever we collectively decide to do so. So in our minds, we perfectly reversed the way the world actually works. And you're right. I mean, so many of us have been in denial about this for, you know, forever. But because the floods are getting worse, denial is not really going to work very well anymore. Right. I mean, it never did. It's going to get way worse. And that's really is why I wrote the book when I did. Now, because of climate change, there are many, many indications and verifications that indicate the floods are going to grow worse than they have been. You know, the floods of the future are going to dwarf the floods of the past. And that's a pretty grim scenario.
Yeah.
But we can do something about it. You know, we need to quit relying on dams, levees, and relief and tune in instead to what we can do to actually get rid of this problem. And that is by getting away from the danger. Not everybody can do that.
Right.
You know, we're not going to move St. Louis and Memphis and Portland, Oregon. And place. There are places, including in New England, where we have levees and we kind of need them to protect intensive investments that have been made. And people who live in those areas will have to pay to do that. But for much of the rest of the country, that's not going to work because it's going to be way too expensive to deal with the floods of the future. And instead, we're going to have to, as I said, protect that open space that remains and move off of the floodplain wherever we can.
Mm. Boy, it's a big, big project, but we got to face reality. I mean, of course, if we don't face reality, we keep on going down the same road again and getting the same disasters. And,
right.
You know, one of the ways that people look at controlling climate change and global warming is new, more sustainable sources of energy. What about hydropower? Hydropower, you know, uses the power of water flow to generate electricity. How has that been done so far? And is that, what do you think about it, the place for that?
Yeah. Well, the relationship to flooding here, of course, is that global warming is causing the floods to be worse. And to stop global warming, we have to quit burning fossil fuels. So you're right. Renewable energy is the direction we need to be going. Hydropower is usually considered one of those, quote, renewable energies.
Mm-hmm.
But it's way more complicated than that. For one thing, we have already built virtually all the hydropower dams and generating facilities that it is economically wise to build. We've been doing this for 200 years. The any site we pick now for more hydropower development, you know, is the one that was never feasible before.
Yeah.
And it's likely got to be again. So hydropower is about 12% of our energy supply today, and it's probably not going to get to be much more than that. I mean, the other truly renewable sources, you know, are solar power and wind power and perhaps geothermal power, and primarily energy conservation. You don't really hear much about that anymore, but there's vast potential to do that without looking at damaging more natural rivers by trying to squeeze a little more hydropower out of them.
Good.
So that's, you know, that's kind of my view on and of course, the hydroelectric dams have virtually nothing to do with flood control. It's a totally different purpose in the use of the dam that's not really all that compatible typically with flood control, because with hydropower, you need to be releasing water when the power is needed. And for flood control, you need to be releasing water so that you have room in the reservoir when the floods come. And those are two different scenarios here. Now, dams can be compromised to do both, but you know, building a hydropower dam does not mean you're going to get flood control by any means.
Oh, interesting. Well, if we think about dams, probably the first one that comes to people's mind is the big Hoover Dam in California. I believe, if I'm correct, there would be no sprawling hugely overdeveloped Southern California were it not for the Hoover Dam in Colorado. That does make a lot of electricity, and it's been problematic for the region. And you say that dams or levees do at times prevent flood damage, but the costs of them have never been adequately repaid or, for that matter, accounted for. We talked a bit about, well, talk a little bit more about the effect of dams on the environment. I mean, I can't imagine back in the 30s when the Hoover Dam was built, whoever thought about the environment.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, don't get me wrong, not all dams have been a mistake, certainly. And the people building them were honestly doing what they thought was the best thing. But we've built a lot of them.
Yeah.
And we started out with the ones that made the most economic sense and worked kind of down the line to today when all those have been built. And so not only is it now kind of uneconomic to invest in this form of, quote, flood control, but there are other costs that for years and years were kind of hidden. You know, people didn't really think much about them, which is what you've asked about here. Number one, to build a dam, you permanently flood the area upstream of the dam in order to avoid temporary flooding of the land below the dam. So, you know, you got to ask, you know, what's the net effect here? Whole towns, whole Indian nations, not so far from you, the Seneca Nation of the Iroquois Confederacy, was completely flooded out by flood control dam on the Allegheny River in Pennsylvania and moved into New York State so that Pittsburgh could have flood control. It's, you know, it's a long, sordid story I tell in my book. But the, you know, at the time, people didn't really, you know, a lot of people didn't think about it. The Indians did, of course, but a lot of people did not think that, okay, you build a dam, you're flooding out everybody upstream of it. So that's one thing. Another problem is that the dams, by holding back the water, affect the flow downstream. They reduce the seasonal pulses that are so critical to native life, including our native and wild fisheries downstream and even in the oceans offshore. They heat the water because the water in the reservoir warms up. They they changed the whole ecology of the stream, of the river downstream, because of holding that water back and releasing it on some, you know, artificial schedule. So those are just a few of the problems that we have with dams. But my main point here is we did a lot of that and to relatively little effect on floods. Flood damages have still increased continually through our history of spending billions trying to stop the floods, trying to contain them with levees. And so in spite of all that effort, damages are still getting worse because we have neglected the real fundamental problem, which is building in the wrong places.
Building in the wrong places. For those who just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about having land that we can have democracy on. Our guest is Tim Palmer, who's got an interesting, very timely new book called Seeking Higher Ground, the Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. One more question relative to dams. There's a lot to talk about. How did dam building morph into a real estate juggernaut, benefiting not flood victims so much as speculators waiting in the wings to make low-value floodplain land available? What about that kind of greedy aspect of our economy?
Yeah, interesting question, Bert. And along with that, I found it very interesting that even the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the big flood control dam builder, opposed building dams for flood control up until the 1936 Flood Control Act, when Congress directed them to quit focusing so much on levees and instead start building dams as well. Even back then, the Corps knew it was not really economic to build a lot of those flood control dams. But once they were authorized to do that, and once the money began to roll, they were all in, you know, and they set out to, you know, build dams wherever they possibly could. Mm-hmm. So this juggernaut you talk about is that Local developers who see the potential for new building on floodplains and, in fact, invest in properties there realize that if they get a flood control dam built upstream, that land will be much more valuable. And so they have historically, you know, through the years, pulled together to elect politicians that will agree with that approach and authorize big money for the Army Corps to build a dam. The Corps, of course, loved that because it's a bureaucracy building, you know, juggernaut. They build the dam. It indeed stops the small and medium-sized floods, so the land downstream from the dam appears to be protected. But in fact, it's not from the really big floods.
Uh-huh.
But yet, they build the dam. You know, it reinforces what the local developers wanted. They, in turn, contribute more to the politicians that agree with them, who fund the Army Corps more to build more dams. And on down the line it goes. This went on kind of, you know, like just a wildfire until the 1980s, when basically we quit building big flood control dams because it became an irrefutable fact that we were out of the good, feasible, economic sites to do that.
Mm. So what alternatives to dams are possible, practical or economic?
Well, the you know, the big alternative historically was to build levees. So you're still going to have the flood, but you build a levee to keep it away from your homes. And that works so long as the levee's tall enough and maintained well enough and the storms are not big enough. But we've had problems with all of those things. So levees have had their limitations, too. And it wasn't until the 60s and 70s when the movement for what became termed floodplain management really became kind of a viable option or, you know, considered seriously. And with that, you know, the emphasis was turned toward these things that I talk about. You're protecting floodplains, relocating people where possible. And virtually everyone agrees that's a good idea whenever you can do it. And there are a lot of great programs that have done that. I mean, places as you might think unlikely as Nashville, Tennessee and Charlotte, North Carolina have fabulous programs to protect floodplain open space and relocate people who want to go. But the amount of money we're actually spending doing that is still a drop in the bucket compared to what we spend on dams, levees, and relief. A group called the Natural Resources Defense Council cranked thousands of data points on this issue and determined that for every $1.70 the federal government spends helping people to relocate and get out of the floodplain and be done with the problem, we as taxpayers spend $100 helping people stay where they are.
Ooh.
And we do that through flood relief, through heavily subsidized federal flood insurance, and through other programs to aid people in, quote, flood-proofing the buildings where they are, rather than getting up and getting out of harm's way. So we need to reverse that ratio to get on what I consider the right track here.
Wow. This flood insurance, that's not economical, to put it mildly, but it has been going on for a long time. That's very, very interesting. And too bad the politicians don't think longer term. Generally, they don't. Are you talking about national flood? There's a flood insurance, national flood insurance program.
Yeah.
What is that? Is it a good idea?
Yeah,
and what, if anything, is wrong with it?
Bert, this was a great idea. You know, the National Flood Insurance Program dates back to the late 50s and early 60s, but it was pretty much unrecognized until the Agnes flood of 1972.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, the federal kind of analysts figured out that, well, gosh, we get this program, but no one's using it. That big flood I talked about in Wilkes-Barre, the Agnes flood in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, 100,000 people got dislocated. Two of them had flood insurance.
Ugh.
So a new law was passed to bolster that program by making flood insurance a requirement for federally backed mortgages, which virtually all mortgages are. And what was really brilliant about this plan was it was kind of a carrot and stick approach. The Congress decided that, yes, we will subsidize federal flood insurance because people can't afford it otherwise. You know, the insurance companies are well informed. They know that insuring floodable property is not a good investment. So it costs way too much for any normal person to buy. Congress decided, yes, we'll help people who are already there, perhaps due to no bad decisions of their own. They're victims of floods at this point. We'll subsidize their insurance, provided, however, that the local government takes steps to guarantee that the flood problems in their communities will not get worse. And you do that by zoning the open space so there's not more development there. So it was brilliant. I worked as a county planner at the time. I think I speak for many when I say that I was thrilled with the potential of this program to actually solve the flooding problem once and for all. But it didn't really turn out that way. This is a great example of the law of unintended consequences. The real estate, the banking, the home building industries got deeply involved and made sure that the restrictions on building weren't all that strict, so that too much development continued to occur in the floodplain. And, you know, the rules got watered down, then the rules were not enforced very well. And so the insurance program, which was designed to be self-supporting by people who paid for premiums, has come nowhere close. It's currently at a federal deficit of $22 billion. So it didn't pay its way. Not enough people signed up for the program. The floods continued to get worse. The damages continued to increase. There are ways to reform this program that make absolute good common sense that we have not yet been able to get past. One, for example, is that repetitive flood damage is covered without limits. So you get flooded, you bought federal flood insurance, the taxpayers pay you to help you rebuild, you get flooded the next year, same thing happens. There are actually properties that have collected taxpayer-subsidized insurance payments over 20 different times for one house. Their house is appraised at like $50,000 and has collected $500,000 of insurance payments.
Oh my goodness.
Canada has a far more sensible solution. They pay people once, $100,000 if you get flooded, that's it. You get flooded again, you're on your own. We don't do that. We have no limits on repeated flood damage. And so, of course, this makes a taxpayer incentive for people to just keep rebuilding. And of course, the home builders love that. They'll rebuild houses as long as people will pay them to do that.
Right.
So that's a very simple solution. Another very simple solution is to require disclosure of flood risk when a house is sold.
Yeah.
You know, when you sell a house, you have to have a deed search so the buyer knows they're actually getting a property.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no such protection for flooding.
Wow.
And some states have rules for this. Most are relatively ineffective, and only about half the states have rules at all. So we could require disclosure, and that way people would know if they're buying into a risky investment, which would be a big step forward. So those are just a couple of the really sensible reforms to this program that would not be that hard to make, and yet we still have not done it.
As a homeowner, I'll tell you, and I would like to know if there'd been a flood there before. I mean, hello.
Yeah.
But then common sense is so often missing from legislative efforts, not any casting any aspersions or anything. But we've talked a fair amount about and used the word floodplains. There are city dwellers who might be listening. So for them, let me ask, again, what are floodplains, and why is 7% an important number relative to floodplains in America?
Yeah, well, floodplains are the land that tends to get flooded, and they can be defined in different ways. The most common definition is a 100-year floodplain, which means it's a place on the ground that has a 1% chance of being flooded in any given year. So a 500-year floodplain is a lot more area. That area has only a a lesser chance of being flooded on every given year, but likely in the long run to be flooded once every 500 years. Because of the increasing floods and the inability to map accurately, those maps have underestimated grossly the area to be flooded. So, in fact, we need to be planning on 500-year floods when we've only been planning on 100-year floods. So that's kind of the floodplain definition piece. Now, if you mention you're a city dweller, you know, if you're in a city on a floodplain, it's very likely you have a levee. And most big cities will have to spend the money needed to make that levee be safe. Many, many levees are not safe today because they've not been built high enough or strong enough. Sacramento, California is a classic example, of being endangered by levee failure. Over the past 20 years, they spent $4 billion to upgrade their levee, which has probably made Sacramento a lot safer. But, you know, not very many towns and cities can spend that kind of money. So it becomes a problem here of, you know, how much are you willing to spend to be safe? But our towns and our cities will, for the most part, do what is needed, or let's hope they do. But that vast majority outside, you mentioned 7%, 7% of America is floodplain. That leaves a lot of other area available for development. Uh-huh. Certainly not all 93% is, but some of that is.
Sure.
And is, you know, much more feasible for development than a place where you get flooded and you're at risk, you know, of even losing your life.
I can't help but imagine that in so much development over the past 50 or more years, floodplains weren't even considered. Probably not. Now, the South is known for its levees on the sides of rivers, the purpose of which is to catch the overflow. Couple of questions about levees. Are they now oftentimes too close to the rivers, and how much should levees be set back and the river pathways increased?
Yeah. Well, yes, they typically are too close to rivers, which pinches the river too tightly. Where we can, where we still need the levees, we should move them back if possible. That's really hard to do because the myth of believing you're safe behind a levee has led to a lot of development there. So if you move the levee back, there's a whole lot, usually a lot of development, you know, that we end up outside the levee instead of inside. And so we don't do that. But in cases where there's not much development, like farmland, which, again, is most of the levee frontage in floodplain in America, is relatively undeveloped, it may make sense to move the levee back, give the river more room to flow. However, it's probably cheaper in a lot of those cases to simply buy all of the land that's flood-prone and get rid of the levee altogether, rather than build a whole new levee, which on average costs $20 million a mile. So we need to look at that as an option, you know, to moving levees back.
So are you suggesting perhaps it makes more sense to let the rivers flood without the levee, and maybe that makes economic sense, but it's kind of difficult to do politically.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, it's difficult to do, as I said, in any urban areas. But there are areas where that does make sense. The Army Corps has actually had projects on the Mississippi River where they've done that and, you know, opened it up, the river channel up for better flows. The other really compelling reason to do that is when you pinch the river tightly like that, when you have levees on both sides, the water goes up a lot higher than it would have before, and that creates more wear and tear on the levees. And so you're actually putting the levee at risk by raising it and confining the river so much. So part of the advantage to moving the levees back is not only just to accommodate more flood water, but to actually protect the levee that you already have. And so that's another compelling economic argument to do that. But you're right. I mean, where people will have to move, it's always a really difficult situation. But with flooding, there are a lot of places where people don't have to move, or not a lot of people have to move, where the thing that makes engineering and economic and sense, you know, we should be looking at that option.
We have to look at that option. The climate change is real. We can't keep putting it off and sweep it under the rug. It's here now, and there's a lot of floods going on. For those listeners who may have just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest today is Tim Palmer, author of a new book, Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. I wonder how many people in government are picking this up. Are they even on to this issue, with regard to development and, you know, what's good economically? I would hope that they would. And this part of where I am in my neck of the woods on the very, very short New Hampshire coast, it seems people from a lot of other states are, dare I say, flooding the area. This development is going at a breakneck speed. I wonder, can municipalities, the state, the federal government, better limit where developers can build? How realistic is that? Is that? I can't help but think that that's a big part of any realistic solution.
Yeah, you're totally right, Bert. But the and coastal flooding is a little different from river flooding in that we know sea levels rising, you know, and we've got hurricane storms that make the floods extremely dramatic and destructive. And yet we have all this coastal development. In fact, it's actually in many of our coastal areas, development within the flood zone is occurring at a greater pace than development outside the flood zone.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy. But, as you have said, a day of reckoning is coming. The floods are only going to get worse. We can't, we just can't continue to invest in property that we know is going to end up flooding anyway. And ultimately, it's hard to imagine that, you know, the taxpayers will be willing to do that, to subsidize this kind of development. We're not quite there yet because, you know, again, we're still in denial, but I think awareness of the situation is growing.
Yeah.
When floodplain management was first considered in the 30s and 40s and up through the 60s and 70s, it was very much kind of a minority view because we still had the hubris to believe we could stop floods.
Yeah.
You know, but now, you know, that's just crazy. We can't do that. And I think we do know that. It's just a question of now having the political will to make the long range decisions that are best for everybody.
Huh. Political will for the best of everybody. What a concept. My goodness gracious. What are some of the risks of the politicization of flood maps? Politicization of flood maps and other weather related science. What do you mean by politicization here?
Right. So flood mapping is done by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
No, they've been busy.
And they, they use hydrologic analysis and come up with these maps. And then the maps as zones for development have to be adopted by local communities. And it is at that point that political influence comes into play. And, you know, development interests will want to minimize that area. And, for example, to protect, say, only the 100-year floodplain and not the 500-year floodplain. And it gets way worse than that. You know, within the 100-year floodplain, they will want most of the land to be zoned as what's called a flood fringe area, which is defined as part of the 100-year floodplain that is not seriously endangered, even though it's likely to flood once every 100 years. Mm. So they they try to influence the political process here and the adoption of the maps and the administration and enforcement of the zoning ordinance and so forth. And, and they often succeed because other people usually have a whole lot less skin in the game. And so, municipalities frequently side with the developers who want to do this. And so the zoning is not as effective as it should be. Now, the answer to that, of course, is better engagement by everybody. You know, let's call that democracy.
Whoa, there you go.
Yeah. And, we need to be looking at the greatest good for the greatest number of people here, not just, for who happens to own some land and has influence in local government.
Right. It's so important. And, democracy, people, unfortunately, a lot of people feel like they've given up on having any power, but we do have power. It always has taken political pressure, people making noise, people standing up, calling attention to issues to make any real change. It doesn't happen without that.
Yeah. Let me add here that the brighter side of this is that we, because of the flood insurance program, we do now have floodplain zoning of one kind or another in most municipalities across the United States. And when I worked as a planner in the 70s, that was a dream. It was very rare to have a floodplain ordinance. Now we have them almost everywhere. We have all these issues of how much is protected and how well and how is it enforced. But we have floodplain zoning in effect many, many places, and many communities actually do a good job of enforcing it and are taking good progressive steps on, controlling the kind of hazardous development and encouraging development elsewhere. And again, I mentioned these southern cities like Knoxville and Nashville, who have local regulations that far exceed what what FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, requires in its federal flood insurance guidelines. They're doing a better job than that, and they actually get a lot of support from the people living there. I asked the floodplain manager in Nashville, for example, so every time this comes up, are you fighting this battle of people say, well, it's my land, I should be able to do whatever I want with it? And his response was, I think we're past that at this point. We've been through that battle. That really does not come up anymore because people there see the wisdom of the program that's efficiently and effectively and equitably managed and administered to help everybody.
Yeah. People, local participate, well, people being able to participate in it. And you kind of anticipated my next question about which political entity may be best suited to addressing flooding challenges. There's municipalities, states, the federal government, maybe some combination. Local people like to have participation in it. What about local participation in decision making? You already referred to one.
That's absolutely critical, of course, Bert. I mean, like with everything, democracy works from the bottom up. And so people in local communities need to be concerned about this issue and make sure their community is doing the right thing. But that does not contradict the importance of the federal government leading the way here, because the federal incentives through subsidies and through federal developments and through tax breaks and through the insurance program and all these things are really, really important. And so the federal government needs to lead the way here on pointing, to the direction we all must follow.
I wonder if there are people in Congress, I mean, there's 435 members in that House, who have demonstrated some knowledge and awareness of this and participation. Maybe those people from, Tennessee that have seen it work?
I can't speak for them. I mean, Tennessee's federal representatives are a whole different cut from the local politicians in the Nashville metro area, that made the good decisions on this. Nashville, just to put it in stark terms, Nashville is a very blue city and a very red state. But there are, if you forget about Congress today, which, of course, is dysfunctional, we all know that.
Oh, yeah.
and think about a reasonable Congress, you know, that we had up till, say, 1995, you know, when compromise and negotiation was, you know, it was widely practiced.
Yeah.
When bipartisanship of issues, like a lot of issues of conservation, you know, like water quality and air quality, bipartisanship was very common in issues that really benefited everybody. But it's not today.
Yeah.
You know, today, I mean, you just get no cooperation in trying to do something, you know, that's even remotely progressive. And part of that is because the conservative world views have been attached to strong vested interests.
Yeah.
That, you know, so there's money and background forces at play here, convincing conservative voters to actually support things that are not all that good for them even, you know, but that are good for big money in the area.
Right. Boy, there's
we've got a lot of cleanup to do here in the political realm.
Boy, that's putting it mildly. And, you know, you would think issues like flood control, they're, you know, the water doesn't care if you're blue or red. It's coming down. I mean, we're not ostriches. We know that it's happening. So this may be, at least in theory, an opportunity for, if the people speak up at the local level, for some sort of bipartisan effort. It's a big challenge for sure. And politicians like to avoid challenges and like to go for the campaign contributions. And that's been a problem. Yeah. But maybe if people raise their voices enough and recognize the flooding issue, that we can't just keep going the way we're going, you know, and just developing everywhere.
Yeah. You know, I make that point in my book, Bert, the different view of this topic, you know, basically my view here, protect floodplains, relocate where you can, has conservative roots in that it's a very conservative notion that we should take responsibility for our own lives. Mm. And that means not living in a danger zone. And it appeals to a very, you know, liberal view of protect the environment, help people who are most disadvantaged, you know, and strive for equitable solutions to these problems. So doing the right thing here certainly crosses political lines in a traditional sense. Now, you know, Congress doesn't operate in traditional ways now, but I remain hopeful, you know, that we'll come to our senses. And that what really is the sound solution here from an engineering standpoint, an economic standpoint, an equitability standpoint, all of these things conforms to both very conservative views and very liberal views. You know, everyone can agree we don't want to drown in a flood, you know, and we don't want to lose our house and everything we own in a flood. So let's start out from that and figure out what will actually work.
Yeah, that sounds like, I mean, there's the real conservative, conserve. I mean, think about the concept of conserve. That's these right-wingers, they ain't conservative. I don't know what the hell they are. But, you know, people, I mean, development happens a lot. I'm amazed how much it happens. And one of the most attractive features about a chunk of real estate is living close to the water, to a lake, to a stream. And I'm reminded, I was in Outward Bound very many years ago, and the counselor at the time, we were camping by a rather busy, loud river, and he said, "The best people are like rivers; they're hard to live with." And so people want to live close to the water. There's beauty and peacefulness. We can't change that. Comments, please.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm a river guy. I love rivers. That's how I got into this whole subject.
Uh-huh. You know,
most of my 32 books are about rivers and river conservation.
Nice.
Okay, I'm an example. I live in Oregon. There was the cabin of my dreams was for sale on the banks of the Rogue River. So I called the realtor up, and we met there, and I took a look at it and asked the question, is this likely to flood?
Uh-huh.
And the realtor says, oh, no, they built a dam upstream that'll never flood again.
Uh-huh.
So that didn't quite match my eyeball test, you know, and the negotiation didn't quite come up to my sniff test of the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the county office and looked at the floodplain maps, and sure enough, I was right in the middle of a floodplain. And I would have just been waiting for what they now call an atmospheric river with my name on it. So I didn't buy that property, but somebody else did, you know, and they probably didn't know. But we just need to be taking a fresh look at this issue, you know, without bias to our politics or to, you know, past views and beliefs like that a dam can save us from floods, and face the realities of today for what they are.
Gosh, facing realities. Who wants to do that?
Well, we all have to do it.
We have to do it.
Surprise.
Yeah, and you've observed that, quote, in our minds, we've perfectly reversed the way the world actually works. And nowhere is this decision more evident than a flooding river. Can we never, never out-engineer nature, really? Please explain.
Well, not in the long run, not in any absolute sense. I mean, we do, you know, I mentioned that dam that kicked the Indians out of their reservation from a treaty signed by George Washington, you know, the Seneca Nation in Pennsylvania that got moved to New York that we talked about earlier. You know, that dam has, in effect, stopped floods in Pittsburgh since that time. So, you know, so there are cases where it seems to have worked,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of cases where it doesn't. Look at Oroville Dam in California, the tallest dam in America,
mm-hmm.
built in the 60s and 70s. And it was very close to failure in 2012 because of massive snowmelt that would have overtopped the dam. They had to release it through an emergency spillway that was eroding, with dangers of having the total dam fail. So, you know, here's a case where we thought we were totally safe and, you know, engineered, but we were not. And, you know, as we said repeatedly here, now the floods are getting worse.
Right.
So, you know, what has even seemed to have worked perhaps so far is something that we can't necessarily count on in the future.
As with so many things, a sledgehammer approach isn't always the best. Sometimes just fine-tuning, you know, it's not as much fun as using a sledgehammer, bang, but it's what's necessary. And the title of your book is Seek Higher Ground. And again, we're talking to the author, Tim Palmer, author of the book, Seek Higher Ground, the Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. What would seeking higher ground look like on a national, perhaps systemic scale? What's your vision?
Well, let's just dream for a minute that we could actually make all this work.
You know,
and that we actually did stop new development on most floodplains, and that we were able to help people relocate wherever they want to go. And so that all those lightly populated areas that are subject to flood damage now became open space again.
Uh-huh.
We would be creating the most beautiful, desirable system of greenways in America.
Hmm. You know,
this is the final chapter of my book. If we actually did this, we would be returning, well, first of all, protecting what remains of many of our riverfronts and returning other mileage to nature so that it would go back to being a corridor of riparian life, the riparian or riverfront habitats, the most important for wildlife. And of course, fish need natural shorelines to survive for many reasons. And people love these urban greenways and parkways and riverfronts for recreation, for trails, bikeways, for swimming, you know, for enjoying in all kinds of leisure ways. We would be creating the most magnificent system of greenways imaginable. And in aggregate, they would be the greatest national wildlife refuge ever created, because we'd be protecting all these different threads of greenway and natural habitat nationwide. So, you know, I think if you're willing to just step back and say, well, where could this take us?
Mm-hmm.
It could take us to a truly magnificent place. If we don't do that, what are we looking at?
No.
Well, We're looking at way more development in floodplains. We're looking at people depending more and more on levees and dams are going to fail more and more. If not now, in the long term, you know, every flood control dam is ultimately going to be filled with silt and be of no value for flood control. You know, we're looking at a long-term nightmare if we don't change our MO in this regard. If we did change it, we could have a magnificent system of greenways linking our communities together by recreational parkways and people living in a much safer way than they do today.
You know, it can be done. This is not impossible. This is not a dream. It's a lot to ask
right.
for. I mean, maybe your dream, because you've written so many books about the subject, it's a good dream, and other people have got to be interested in it because there's this
yep.
flooding going on. And as you
yep.
say, we need to adjust our expectations, habits, and laws accordingly. We can do it. It's going to take a lot of pushing from a lot of people. Interesting stuff. The book is called Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. And who is the publisher? I didn't get that.
It's the University of California Press.
Uh-huh.
They are an academic publisher, but, you know, it's not an academic book. It's a book for everyone to read. And, you know, I think that'll be evident when you pick it up.
Oh, excellent. Tim Palmer, thank you so much for being with us and for shedding a little light on what's possible and how we can have a better world, a greener world. It's been done. There's a lot of examples of things where little adjustments are made and nature can live more happily. And rivers and floodplains, the water can be absorbed as it's meant to be absorbed and not as it's been, you know, not just yanked out of where it's going to go anyway. Thank you so much. Again, the book is titled Seek Higher Ground, The Natural Solution to Our Urgent Flooding Crisis. Tim Palmer, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Hey, thank you, Bert. It's been my pleasure to be with you and to have this discussion.
Here's The Water Song by Hot Tuna. If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. And if you find the information valuable, your friends probably do too. Please ask them to also subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.